Hi, welcome everybody. Welcome to the Be Healthy Summit and welcome Dr. Inau Nzimaabat.
Nzimaabat, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on your summit.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us. It's a pleasure to have you on. Born in London and raised in Nigeria, Dr. Inau Nzimaabat has over 23 years of experience in the health and wellness industry. She graduated in 1987 as one of the top 10 graduating students from the University of Calabar, Nigeria, with several awards. Congratulations. When she worked as a primary care physician with a large multi-specialty group in the greater Chicago area, she was a recipient for the quarterly award for compassion. She's an award-winning author of a book for people living with type 2 diabetes entitled Dr. Inau's A to Z Guide to Thriving with Type 2 Diabetes. So I'm excited to have you on. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself? What's your story, Dr. Inau?
Sure. So, my story goes all the way back to the premature baby. Way back in the 60s. And I like to share this story because it really lends to this term called resilience. The way the story goes was that my mother was going into eclampsia, which is a bad form of hypertension that can affect women and lead to death. And so in the 60s, one of the easiest ways to, you know, to curtail that was to deliver the, in quotes, fetus. Now, I was barely 7 months, 28 weeks, and I was dumped into a stainless steel bin, and a student nurse heard me squeal, and the rest is history. I have not stopped squealing since then. So I like to share that story, especially for people who, you know, may be going through trials and tribulations, people who may have premature infants, and I like to stand up and say, hey, look at me here. You know, the odds were really very low that this baby would survive, and she did. And that is really one of the reasons I became a physician. I'm British born, but Nigerian parentage. And most times, traditionally, your parents kind of nudge you in the direction of your career. And so my mother, who was a nurse, had made a promise that if this baby survived, that she would become a doctor to give back. And so that was my story. From the time I was young, I knew I was going to be a doctor. My mother, like I said, was a nurse. And so, you know, I just knew a lot about being in the hospital. And I came out of medical school, as you could see, at a pretty young age. And I've been a physician since. Now, during that journey, there's been a nagging ache. Like, it's great to be able to cure people of acute illnesses, but over the course of my career, I've come to realize that the burden is really on chronic illnesses. And it's really weighed heavily on me because I feel like, or I felt like I wasn't making a difference. Like, you know, patients came in and out, week after week, month after month, and you weren't really, in quotes, healing them, right? You were just, to me, it felt like assembly line medicine, number one, when I was part of a multi-specialty group. Number two, it just felt like there was something lacking in the healthcare system that I found myself. And so that led me down, you know, explorations. I was like, you know, at one point I came across coaching and really became very excited about it. I was like, oh my goodness, maybe if I learned how to coach, I could engage patients. Because I really found, and I don't know whether that's the same thing over there in Germany, but I find we do know that in the American system especially, our healthcare system tends to be paternalistic. In other words, you know, it's healthcare is being done to you, right? A patient comes, sits down, and is told what to do. There's no real dialogue. And I didn't find that exciting. I really wanted to engage my patients in their healthcare. And I felt that through coaching, I could do that. Now, at the same time, I also became very passionate about diabetes simply because I found that a lot of my patients, when I informed them they either had pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes, instantly went from zero, i.e. they've been diagnosed with diabetes, all the way to the complications that they had seen happen to their relatives. And I was like, what kind of belief system is that? Why would you instantly go from, I've just been diagnosed with diabetes, to I'm going to lose my legs, end up with a heart attack, end up on dialysis and a stroke? Didn't make sense to me. And so I became even more passionate about engaging my patients and helping them see that if they began to incorporate simple small steps to improve their lifestyles and make it more healthy, that perhaps they could avoid these, in quotes, complications. And so I kept on going, and eventually I found a tribe of patients who were really very engaged and excited about coming to show me their blood sugars and, you know, how well their A1Cs were, et cetera, et cetera. And a patient, you know, I casually mentioned to a patient once, I said, you know, I'm getting great results. I have a small set. It was a small set. I'm not going to say it was a large proportion of my patients, but I had a small set of patients who really kind of lit me up, so to speak, made it worth my day coming to work, because I knew I'd see one or two of them and they'd be engaged about their diabetes and how their blood sugars were doing and how they were noticing that if they did X, Y happened, and, you know, really, really becoming that engaged patient. And I said to the patient, I said, you know, maybe I should write a book, because I'm kind of saying the same thing over and over again, and I'm producing this great result in this small subset. And she said, why don't you? And I'm like, ooh, I really didn't mean it like that. It was just supposed to be a casual conversation. And so I literally sat down at my kitchen table about 8-10 years ago. And I was like, well, if you want to write a book, you know, there's diabetes books out there all the time. But what would you want your book to look like? And it came to me that I wanted it to look like the kind of person I was in the exam room. Playful, informative, but not necessarily stern, a cheerleader for my patients, and getting them engaged. And so I got this download to write the book using the letters of the alphabet to describe different aspects of diabetes. And so I had it. It became Dr. Eno's. It was initially published by one publisher, and then we revised it. And then last year we relaunched it as Dr. Eno's A to Z Guide to Thriving with Type 2 Diabetes. And I emphasize that word thriving, because I think it's an important mindset when it comes to living with any chronic illness, no matter what it is. And so that's my journey in the nutshell. And in that period of time, after coaching, I was still kind of hungry. I was like, there has to be something else. I have this skill, but I don't have a toolbox. You know, you know about basic things about vitamins and nutrition, but I wanted a broader toolbox. And I subsequently came across the Institute of Functional Medicine. And as we speak, in a couple of hours, I'll be taking the functional medicine certification. So I've completed all the modules. And I kid you not, at that point, I realized I had found my tribe. Like, I wasn't crazy when I kept on thinking about how, you know, why don't we talk about the mind-body connection when it comes to illness? Why don't we emphasize, you know, emotional health and mental health? Why are we just, you know, about the pill for every ill? And so with functional medicine, it's like I've come full circle. I have the tools to treat acute illnesses if need be, but I also have the tool to help people to truly heal in a language that allows them to explore several dimensions. So it's truly exciting.
Wow, thank you for sharing that. I got goosebumps when you told your story. Very touching. Can you go a little bit deeper into what diabetes is in the first place? There are several types, but maybe not everybody is familiar with that.
Absolutely. And, you know, incidentally, you know, we're just coming up on the National Diabetes Month at the time of this recording. So, you know, and I made a commitment when I did some media last year to always emphasize, because a lot of times people say, diabetes is a disease of lifestyle, right? And that sounds almost flippant, like, you know, if you have type 2 diabetes, it's your fault. Not necessarily so. But there's also a distinction I'd like to make. First up, the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So type 1 diabetes as a whole, diabetes mellitus, that's the full medical term, refers to a metabolic disorder that essentially creates high blood sugars in addition to other metabolic derangements, but the high blood sugars in the bloodstream are what actually define diabetes mellitus. Now, there is type 1 diabetes mellitus, which initially used to be called juvenile onset diabetes. It's an autoimmune condition. In this condition, the body has formed what we call antibodies against the cells of the pancreas that are responsible for secreting insulin. This has nothing to do with lifestyle. A type 1 diabetic is usually diagnosed early in life, usually under the age of 10. And so that's why it used to be called juvenile onset diabetes. This is totally distinct and separate from type 2 diabetes mellitus, which usually occurs a lot later in life. Although I must prefix that we are beginning to see type 2 diabetes in kids as young as their teens. And that's why this, in quotes, lifestyle factors play a role. Now, when I refer to lifestyle, I especially want to emphasize that a lot of times what we're finding is, it's not necessarily just, you know, the fact that we're not exercising or we're eating, in quotes, the standard American diet. I don't know what you call it up there in Germany, but we call it the standard American diet, processed foods, high sugars, refined simple carbohydrates. But also the fact that we have a number of chemicals that are in our food and in our environment that we're unconsciously exposed to that alter the body's signaling system, the mitochondria, and could also play a role in the onset of diabetes. So yes, type 2 diabetes is usually called a disease of lifestyle, but a lot of times there may be a subset of people out there who for no known reason of theirs. And for instance, you see people who, you know, they're skinny, right? So they're skinny, but they have type 2 diabetes. And, you know, that really begins to make you think that there's more than just the, you know, the eating simple carbs and not exercising. So type 2 diabetes, again, usually relates to what we call insulin resistance. In other words, the pancreas is still secreting insulin, but the cells in the body, that is the skeletal muscle and the liver, are not as responsive as they should be to the signal from insulin. And so you have an accumulation of sugars in the bloodstream.
Okay, thank you. And you said that you focus on thriving. What can people do when they are affected by diabetes and still want to thrive?
Yes, so, you know, like I said, with the book, I had this download, right? And I was using letters A to Z. And so I said, okay, so what would A stand for? And I instantly came up with A for acceptance. So the first three letters of the alphabet in my book stand for what I define as the foundational principles of living with any chronic illness, be it type 2 diabetes, an autoimmune disease, whatever it is. And it's A for acceptance, B for belief, and C for commitment to change. And I emphasize that without those three things, without those three tenets, the rest of what I say, the rest of what I write, the rest of what I explain about type 2 diabetes makes no difference. Acceptance, we can go into acceptance, for instance. I have found a lot of patients in the course of my career, you know, you tell them they have diabetes and like, oh, no, can't be, don't want to pay attention, stick their head in their head in the sand and keep it moving, right? Then they come back, you know, years later with the complications that could have been avoided. So it's important to accept where you are, what's so, okay? And I've used these principles in my personal life, in my cancer journey. So acceptance, what is so? Hey, I have type 2 diabetes. Hey, I have cancer. Hey, I have high blood pressure. What's so? Then you now move through to belief. Now, there's a very important thing when it comes to beliefs. Remember how I said that a lot of patients, when I told them they had type 2 diabetes, they instantly went from zero to boom, the complications. That's because they have a certain belief system that's operating within them. All of us have a belief system, right? That's the background. It's kind of like the background tape playing in our minds. Some of us have limiting beliefs. Most of us do operate through limiting beliefs. And then some of us have beliefs that allow us to expand, right? So we need to be aware of our beliefs. We need to address our beliefs. There's nothing shameful about saying, you know, all I've known is Aunt, you know, Martha who lost a leg, Uncle Paul who ended up on dialysis, and Aunt Cindy who had a heart attack and died. So there's nothing wrong with that belief system. Being able to address your belief system and knowing them for what they are. Beliefs, for the most part, are a story that we either have told ourselves or we continue to tell ourselves or have been told in the past, right? So it's important to address our beliefs and know what are limiting beliefs and what are beliefs that allow us to expand. And then the third part is commitment to change. So, hey, you're right here, right? You're like, okay, doc just told me I have type 2 diabetes. And they told me I need to go out there and make some changes. And, well, change, that's why we have summits like this, right? Because change sounds easy, but it is hard. And we need to acknowledge it and really understand that there are several stages to change. And I like to walk patients and clients through that, because once you get present to the fact that a lot of times we just go straight into action. Action is about the fourth stage of change. Before you get into action, there's the pre-contemplation, there's the contemplation, there's a preparation before you get into action. A lot of times we like to get straight into action, and we need to really be present to, okay, where am I when it comes to, making lifestyle changes? And I like to emphasize, because, you know, our brain is I don't want to call it tricky. It's a very intelligent organ, right? Our mind is a very intelligent organ. It's designed to keep us smack dot in our comfort zone. And so when we try to make huge changes, there's a part of the brain called the amygdala. It's part of the reptilian brain, which is that primitive brain that kept us safe, right? So we wanted to stay away from the saber-toothed tiger in the old times, or the dinosaur, whatever. And so the amygdala, any change in our environment or any unusual sound, alarm, ooh, freeze, flight, fight. When we try to make huge changes, it triggers the amygdala all over again. It's like, whoa, what do you mean we're gonna get rid of the sugar and the pop and the fried chicken and the cake? Whoa! And so we need to learn, I like to emphasize, making simple, small changes, taking simple, small steps. It's actually a principle mirrored after the Japanese Kaizen principle, which is taking simple, small steps, and gradually they build up. So those are the three foundational principles to thrive in, because as you begin to embody that, you become more curious naturally. And that is what I found, right, with my patients. They became naturally more curious, like, hey, so if I notice that if I do X, if I exercise, my blood sugars go down. Yay! I notice if I eat late at night, my blood sugars are high the next morning. Whoa! And so it's just that curiosity. I really intend to have a TED talk at some point. So if you know anybody who's on TED, tell them to give me a call. But here's the reason why. This is what my premise is, that diabetic living that is the nutritional lifestyle and even the overall lifestyle of somebody living with type 2 diabetes is actually a healthy lifestyle. And we need to take away that stigma. Yes. And in fact, there's this whole thing about disease, like, you name somebody and so automatically they embrace or they embody that disease. Let's say you're experiencing a condition called diabetes rather than you are diabetic. And by experiencing this condition, there are certain things you need to do to set yourself back on the wellness continuum, right? Back towards the healthy. And so if you think about it in that sense, like, oh, well, my body is trying to help me by becoming resistant to insulin. And so my blood sugars are high. And so this is what manifests as this process called diabetes. And in order to correct that, I need to do X, Y, Z, rather than say, woe is me. I have this condition that is, you know, that defines me. So I find that, you know, we really need to be as healthcare practitioners, as people who are in the forefront of providing information, we need to be very careful about what we speak forth when helping people or looking to help people with certain conditions.
Yeah, that's such a great approach. Thank you for sharing that. And you already mentioned nutrition, which plays a very big role in diabetes too, especially. Can you talk to that a little bit more, please?
Yes. Yeah, so, there are different, we really talk about, I think one of the basic principles that we need to focus on when it comes to addressing type 2 diabetes is carbs, okay? Like carbohydrates, keep it as low as possible. So we like to address a low carb diet and as best as possible, healthy fats and nutrition, fruits and vegetables that can help improve your mitochondrial health and sensitize the cells. So things like more complex, so there's this concept called glycemic load and glycemic index, just as an example. So when we talk about the glycemic index, the higher that the glycemic index is, the higher the sugar, the foods that raise your blood sugars really high, really fast. Okay, so sugar has a glycemic index of about 100. And then you talk about more complex, so you want to incorporate more complex carbs. So things like your sweet potatoes, your yams and stuff like that would be foods that have more complex carbs that take a longer period of time to be digested. And then also your fruits and vegetables. So you want to really pick fruit foods from a wide range of colors. We talk about eating from the colors of the rainbow. And the reason for this is that these foods contain different kinds of nutrients that help to send signals to the cells and also contain different electrolytes and your different B vitamins and also what we call anthocyanins. So it's really what I would say to anybody first up is try as much as possible to limit your carbs. And when you do limit your carbs, try to incorporate more complex carbs. Now, having said that, there are some studies that show in that certain diets, for instance, the ketogenic diet, has been shown to help improve type 2 diabetes. Now, in as much as I don't want to promote the ketogenic diet as the only diet, simply because there are certain what we call SNPs, they're called different genetic polymorphisms that may put you at an increased risk for certain other diseases. For instance, one of the SNPs that we need to be very aware of is the APOE4E3. And if I were to tell somebody who unbeknownst to them has APOE4 to go eat a lot of high fats because they want to be in a ketogenic diet, I'm probably going to be tipping them, you know, tipping their cholesterol, you know, affecting their cholesterol levels and increasing their risk for what we call possibly a mild cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's disease, and also cardiovascular disease. So I don't like to use a blanket term like, hey, go keto, because, you know, that's been found to help improve type 2 diabetes in some studies. But the truth is it does. But I usually recommend let's get really personalized and really individualized when it comes to nutrition plans. I like to call them nutrition plans and not diet, because, you know, diet tends to trigger people in a different way. And when you say diet, it almost sounds like, yeah, there's going to be, it's for a set period of time, right? Like once I reach an A1C or once I reach a weight off, then I'm off the diet. And speaking about diets, even if we use the term diet, there's been research that shows that, you know, if you do lose the weight, for instance, you were on a 1300 calorie diet, that it's important to be aware of the fact that once you reach your target weight, because weight is an important part of being able to optimize or control your blood sugar. So let's say you reach your target weight with a certain diet or nutrition plan. It's important to remember that you need to continue within that calorie range for longer, for up to a year, rather than just quitting once you reach your target weight, because we find a lot of people go through, you know, rebound weight gain, etc. So that's the long answer to using nutrition and really looking at it as a lifestyle. Decreasing what we call glycemic index, so again, lower glycemic index foods, mixing them with good fats and healthy proteins. And there's also a school of thought that talks about really going plant-based when it comes to diabetes. That's also another option. But again, I would like to really encourage people to make sure this is individualized, like it's personalized to where you are in your life, right? That's important.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I have the same approach. I'm also a nutritionist and I also look at the individual. So do you think that we can heal from diabetes holistically without having to take medicine for our whole life?
I believe so. Now, you know, this would have been heresy and I would have probably had my license snatched from me as soon as I got off the show a couple of years ago. Because the medical establishment did not believe it was possible to, and I'd like to use the term reverse type 2 diabetes. Holistically without medications. Now, here's the caveat, okay? And again, I'm an MD, I'm an allopathic physician, and my goal is to do no harm. If you are coming into my hospital with a blood sugar of 700, we're gonna have to treat you with medications, okay? No kidding, that's what it's gonna have to be. However, what I like to tell patients is, you know, the pancreas at that point is stunned. It's like, whoa, like it's so stunned, it's not putting out any insulin. So the goal is, most times patients with blood sugars in the 700s will most likely require insulin initially. And what I try to encourage them is, yeah, this is where you are now. However, it doesn't mean you're gonna have to be there forever if you're willing to take the steps that you need to take to make the adjustments. So initially, some patients may require, depending on how high their blood sugars are, right? Which is why I have this pet peeve, and it drives me absolutely insane when I see the subset of people, and they're about 80 million strong, of people living what is called pre-diabetes, and nobody's doing anything about it. My colleagues are not doing anything. They're just like, yeah, your blood sugar's a little high, go watch your diet. And it's like, what does that mean? What does it mean to just say your blood sugar's a little high? Go. That's when we really need to actively intervene, because you can totally reverse pre-diabetes. You can totally reverse it by diet and lifestyle without even going into medications, even though there are some subset that may require medications like metformin, but you can totally get somebody engaged, get them really thinking about what the implications are about pre-diabetes. Because by the time you have pre-diabetes, you know, those vascular complications have already begun to set in. And by the time you get diabetes, you're wondering, why do I have the neuropathy, and why are my kidneys beginning to fail? Because most times that damage has been going on for 10 to 15 years. And I really, if there is anybody on this, you know, who watches this and remembers a doctor saying to them, you know, your blood sugars are just a little high, and you just, you know, just don't pay attention to it, you need to ask, first of all, how high is it? Okay. You want to know what your numbers are. And even for people who are in quotes normal, i.e. they're in the 90 range, that's also probably an indication of what we call insulin resistance, which I explained earlier on, which may actually be, you know, setting you up for the substrate for diabetes, but not necessarily quite at that range. So in the 90s, I like to, you know, red flag people and say, you know, you really want to get those blood sugars down by really beginning to watch your diet and exercise. Okay. I'll call it movement, okay? So I'm gonna be, because people get triggered by exercise and diet. But movement is critically important. These two are critically important when we're talking about being able to reverse these processes. And I like to emphasize, this is a lifestyle. This is not a destination. Look at it as a lifestyle. Like, what is it? You know, I just had this conversation with somebody recently, and she was like, I'm over 50 and I can't be an athlete. I'm like, why? I consider myself an athlete. Every single day I get on my Peloton bike or I go on a walk, I'm an athlete, right? Because I'm taking the commitment to do something to move my body. So as long as you move your body in some form, yes, you're an athlete. So these things are very important to highlight. If you have ever been told that your blood sugars are a little high, you want to know your numbers. You want to make sure that you even know your A1C, because an A1C, which is the average of your blood sugars over the last 4 to 6 weeks, if your A1C is over 5.7%, for sure you do have borderline, i.e. pre-diabetes. And if it's over 7% or, you know, 5.9%, then you are diabetic. So you really want to pay attention to these numbers. I really want to emphasize to people, if there's anything they can take away from here, know your numbers. Important. Don't just let a doctor say, or your healthcare practitioner say, everything looks fine. No, get your labs and look at them and know your numbers. So that, let's say 2 years ago, your blood sugar was at 80, and then all this, well, in the United States, we use milligrams per deciliter. I think 80 converts to, what is it, about 5? Is that divided by 18? Help me out. I think it's about 4 millimoles per liter in the United Kingdom or in Europe. So if your blood sugars were one number, say they were 4 millimoles or 80, and then all of a sudden 2-3 years later, they're in the 90s, that's a red flag right there. Because your body has a thermostat. It operates within a set thermostat. And so 80 to 90 is a significant shift, and you need to figure out why, and you need to do some introspection, and you need to become empowered about deciding to make those changes for yourself and not necessarily waiting for some doctor or some healthcare practitioner to say, oh, now you're diabetic, now I can treat you. Great.
Yeah, thank you. I hope that gives a lot of people hope. Yes. You said that you had cancer yourself. Do you want to share with us what you did for your healing journey?
Sure. So, you know, I'm still on my healing journey. Okay. So in 2012, and I'm sharing this story. I share this story to share the importance of mental and emotional and how stress can play a role. Okay. I share this not because I feel honored to have gone through cancer and survived, but really I want the viewers to really hear this story. So in 2012, my father died suddenly in March. I mean, I knew he had been declining in health, but I didn't anticipate that I'd get the news that he had passed through transition. And it was, I still remember it being an intense shock to my system. I was also traveling for work, which I still currently do. So I was a travel physician in and out of Chicago, living a very, you know, very stressful lifestyle as a contract physician. In September, I picked up a new job. And so as I was changing insurance, I went for my regular checkup, you know, that's what you do, right? You walk your walk. And I remember, you know, the OB-GYN saying everything looks pretty good. I'm like, cool, all right. Sure, I didn't expect anything wrong. I mean, the previous year, my PAPs had been normal, so you don't expect anything abnormal, right? And then a couple of weeks later, she calls me, and I'm like, oh, I don't like, you know, even though she's my colleague, I don't like doctors. Nobody likes doctors calling, okay? And so she calls, and she's like, you know, your PAP is abnormal. I'm like, but, you know, you said everything's okay, right? Long story short, I was diagnosed with cervical cancer stage one. Now, if you understand the progression of cervical cancer, you'll understand where severe emotional stress can actually rapidly proliferate abnormal cells. Cervical cancer doesn't go from zero to stage one in a year, unless the previous pap smears were not adequately taken, which is probably not the case. So I really, in introspection, feel that the sudden death of my father was a shock to my system that just proliferated these cancer cells, right? Well, fortunately, I went through robot-assisted surgery. I was back on my feet roughly in about 3 weeks and back to work. And, you know, I just kept on in the back of my mind. I remember when I got the cancer diagnosis, I was sitting at the kitchen table again. Gosh, I could do a lot of things at my kitchen table, like most people do. And, you know, I got this message saying, hey, you have cancer. And I remember, fortunately, I had a friend who was a psychiatrist, who was visiting, and I turned to her, I'm like, I've told people in my 20-something year career, I've been the person to tell people they have cancer. And I'm reading this, and it has my name on it. And it says, I have cancer. And it was a shocking and emotional and devastating time in my life. It was humbling. And at that point, I was like, you know, I on some level, I knew I was going to survive. I just knew there was no other option. I had a daughter I needed to raise, and I had, you know, a message I needed to share on the planet. But I knew I was going to survive. But what cancer did for me was, I became a patient, right? So shortly after the surgery, of course, I'm a patient in the hospital. And it really allowed me to really drop in to what it really means to be a patient. It's a very humbling, you're stripped of all your titles as a patient, right? You're stripped of all your title. You're just in there at the mercy of the caregiver and praying that they're good and compassionate to you. And so moving forward for me, when I was able to get back on my feet, and even though I was operating on automatic for a couple of months, as I was going through my own healing, what I've been very present to is that no matter how hard the work gets as a physician, the patient who comes through the door didn't wake up that morning for the most part wanting to be a patient, right? They just wanted somebody else to help them. And so I'm very present to that. No matter how tired I get, I make eye contact and I want to be the healer. In fact, I'd say to you that it has made me a better healer, because I don't just look at the patient as, oh, the patient in room 424, bed 2. I look at the person as a person who has a story, and I love to connect with the story behind the person. And so I say to you that I'm still healing because, you know, I'm kind of bringing my tribe along. You know, I consider myself not a survivor, but a thriver. Like, hey, I went through this and I want to share this message that it's very, very possible to thrive despite going through, having a brush with cancer. I mean, I had access, I kid you not, I had access to all the most terrible things that could possibly happen to you through surgery or through cancer. And I decided that that was not what I was going to populate my mind with. I was going to fill my mind with positivity, with positive outcomes, with radiating love and care into the people who were taking care of me. And I was going to allow my body the opportunity to heal and to continue to heal, to really watch my mindset, to watch my nutrition. I became very, very, present to nutrition, of course, after cancer, to mindset, to movement. And so that's what I really bring forth. Like, I've been on both sides, right? I'm the in quotes healer, and I've also been the patient. And so I look to merge the two and really bring forth a message of compassion and possibility for clients and patients.
Wow, thank you. That is really touching. And I can totally relate, because I had a similar experience after my dad passed away suddenly and totally unexpectedly. And a year later, I also got pretty sick. So I can totally relate to what you're saying.
Yeah, I think we need to, and one thing I really love about functional medicine is that it brings all those things in. Like, honest, before I started functional medicine, I wouldn't have thought about that. Like, traumatic events can really precipitate changes in the body, and we need to be really present to that, right? Like, so how can we begin to educate people about, wow, if you're going through a severe trauma, you really need to up on the sleep and the nutrition and the relaxation, because it's very important. I don't wish this on anybody. I don't wish that anybody goes, through a severe trauma and then a year or a few months later ends up with a chronic illness. So this is a message we really need to, put forth to people. Like, hey, you may think that it's no big deal, getting several hard knocks after hard knocks, but it's really important at that time to really prioritize yourself, which is one of the other things I'm very passionate about. Like, as women, we almost tend to, put ourselves on the back burner. Like, okay, I'll get to me after everybody. But I'm saying this is an invitation to really step ourselves into the forefront and really learn how to set healthy boundaries. And that is something I'm going to be very transparent about. I'm still working on, right? Because it's like, I'm the overachiever. I want to be this. I want to be that. I want to do this. I want to do that. But at the same time, we need to pull ourselves in and say, okay, where am I in this whole smorgasbord of activities I have planned? Where am I? And really connecting with checking in, where am I?
Yeah, and it's probably like that when you get a cancer diagnosis, that you're so scared that you will just say, okay, I need that chemotherapy now. And do you have a recommendation for people to just think about what they want to do and not say right away, okay, I'm going to do that now?
Well, I guess it depends on people's personal preferences. I would say one of the things it was kind of funny. I had people reaching out to me, there's this treatment in Mexico that you need to check out. And again, I'm an allopathic physician. Okay. So for me, it was like, if this is a cancer that can be cut out and I can move on with my life, let's do that. Okay. And so I feel allopathy does play a role, and I feel on the other side, we need to complement allopathic measures, right? So if somebody's going through cancer and decides to go through chemotherapy, I feel we need to be we need to also help support their system with nutritional supplements and lifestyle and mind body and stuff like that. I'm not necessarily going to tell people, I don't think you should do chemotherapy. I think that is a personal decision. And I think it would be irresponsible of us to say, you know, look down on chemotherapy. Chemotherapy does have its benefits, but we need to be aware of, you know, how to support the body whilst going through chemotherapy or whilst going through radiation therapy. It's a personal choice.
Yes, for sure. And it also depends on what kind of cancer you have, of course.
True. True. And I think one of the other important things, just on the topic of cancer, because some stories don't end up the way mine did. Okay, I've seen people die of cervical cancer. Famous country singers have died of cervical cancer. And so I think we also need to be aware that healing can even occur in the process of a chronic disease. And that's not necessarily disease reversal, but that we as practitioners can still assist with the healing process, with coming to some completion, even within the healing process, even within the cancer process, without necessarily causing a remission in cancer. And that ties into, you know, end of life decisions and, you know, how do you want to experience this? That's a choice that people need to be aware that they can make. And it does not necessarily translate into failure at any point.
Yes, so true. Dr. Anno, is there anything else you want to share with us?
Well, I do have some resources that I'll be glad to share with your audience. They're totally free. They're three ebooks that we will definitely provide for your audience. One of them is, so we're talking about the mixture between allopathy and functional or integrative natural health. And so I have a little ebook that talks about the five symptoms women should never ignore. Okay, so that's a very simple ebook. Never ignore it. Never ignore some of these symptoms because they may be indicative of some more serious symptoms. And then I also have, which touches on, you know, lifestyle, optimal strategies to improve your well-being. And then a third ebook, which talks about strategies to relieve stress in under 10 minutes. And I think it's very important, as you know, we're fast-paced women, we live in a fast-paced society, that we really take time to, you know, tone down the sympathetic nervous system. And, you know, I love the fact that you promote yoga, because that's something that, you know, breath is totally like healing and very therapeutic. And a lot of times we tend to breathe from the top part of our lungs and not necessarily the bottom of our lungs. And so we stimulate the sympathetic nervous system, which drives, you know, the adrenaline and the catecholamines and then the further cortisol. And we go into this spiral of, you know, just constantly going and going and going. And so this ebook talks about some strategies to just relieve stress in under 10 minutes. So those are the three resources I am glad to share with your audience. In addition, there's four actually. In addition, there's also the first three chapters of my award-winning book, Dr. Anno's A to Z Guide, for anybody who's interested in, you know, learning more about type 2 diabetes, difference between type 2 and borderline diabetes, and also those first three chapters I spoke about. So that's a free download that will also be provided to your audience.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. And where can people find you?
They can find me at drenno.com, and doctor is spelled out fully. drenno.com.
And do you also work online or just in your practice in Chicago?
So I actually am building an online practice. Thanks for asking. So I'm transitioning. I'm in the process of transitioning. So that's really exciting. So I'll be having a virtual practice online. I also intend to have a small micro practice where people, if they really absolutely have to come in and see me, which hopefully they don't. But I do have a practice, an office based in Chicago. And oh, I also forgot to mention, on the lark, I started a podcast just about a week ago. It's called Thriving While Golden. Now, as you can see, I just love that word, thriving. And Thriving While Golden is geared to the woman over 50. And it's just going to be this laid back kind of, just kind of like the same conversation you and I are having, right? I kind of cover a variety of topics, health, wellness, lifestyle topics, you know, mindset topics. So down the line, we do intend to be able to interview people, but that's something that hopefully will be picking up pretty fast in the next couple of weeks.
Wow, amazing. Dr. Anna, thank you so, so very much for sharing so much insight. It was really a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, and many blessings to you and everybody here. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.